Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
One of the highlight games of the 1912 season was Carlisle at Army, and this is part two of the big coverage on the game on a book by Lars Anderson of the same title, Carlisle versus Army 1912. And the rest of the story comes up for you in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And before we get started with our story in this episode, I want to ask you to send us your feedback, you know, not only about this podcast, but any of your feedback, some things that maybe you want to hear, some things that you like, some things that you don't like, and how we can get better. We want your feedback. PigskinDispatch@gmail.com. Also, you can find us on Twitter at Pigskin Dispatch, and we have a Facebook page called Pigskin Dispatch. Also, I ask you, and it's very important, to rate us and review us on your podcast host. You know, Apple Podcasts has a great review things. You can give stars and ratings and recommendations on there. And please, if you like our stuff, please share it with your friends and family. I think maybe some of them may enjoy this too. And we want to make sure we're getting to as many people as we possibly can. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to our email newsletter. We cover you all the items that we have coming out today from Pigskin Dispatch and the Sports Jersey Dispatch, our other podcasts and website, and all our stories that are on both websites, on both of the dispatches, as well as what's coming up new on Orville Mulligan. You know, Orville Mulligan sports writer is another one of our things that we are involved with, co-producing on that with Oz Davis and our Number 80 Productions team. And we also have some stories coming out on the Sports History Network, all in our newsletter each and every day before 7 a.m. And now, let's get to our story. And this episode is a conclusion to part one of the Carlisle versus Army game of 1912. A book by Lars Anderson of that name, Carlisle versus Army 1912, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Jim Thorpe, and Pop Warner, is the very much so the influencing piece that really inspired me to do this. Now, like I said in our first episode, that the reader and listener, Mark J., sent this to me back 3 or 4 months ago and told me what an excellent book this was and what a great topic and story that author Lars Anderson presented in this book. I got the copy and I read it myself, and boy, was Mark right. This is just tremendous. So I'm going to caution you right now as a spoiler, you are going to want to listen to part one because it really builds up to this game and has the development, and you get to see what each of these main featured people in this game, Dwight D. Eisenhower, yeah, the president before he was president, Pop Warner, the awesome coach, and Jim Thorpe, you know, everybody's favorite athlete of yesteryear, what they did to go through their youth on a parallel track to prepare themselves ultimately to be playing in this game in 1912. So now we're going to get closer to game time. We're going to talk about the game in this episode. And, you know, part one of our segment that just told the story of, you know, how the meeting of the Army cadets and the Carlisle Indians, and, you know, how the author Lars Anderson really presented this as masterfully scripted the parallel bios of the key people from the Titleist book. And, you know, it shows that the maturing process of these players and their determination, their grit, their athleticism, their building of their bodies, building of their minds, getting smarter, how the game was evolving during this whole time. It's just genius how Willard Anderson put together in this game. And it really culminates, he's right, in for these three figures on this day in November 9th, 1912, West Point, New York. You know, so far, at that point in the season of 1912, Army was holding a record of 3-1. Their only loss was, you know, falling to Yale, who was a powerhouse at the time. And they only lost to Yale by the score of 6-0 at home. Now, Carlisle, on the other hand, they were 9-0-1. They were blemished just a little bit. They had a tie against Washington and Jefferson down in Washington, Pennsylvania. And that was kind of a surprise. But, you know, the players were learning from that. It was early in the season that happened. I think it was like week three for the Carlisle Indians. And Mr. Anderson has a couple of great sentences about what was going on through Pop Warner's mind the week before the game with Army. He says, the Army game for Warner was personal. Years earlier, when he was still a young man, Warner had taken the West Point entrance exam, hoping that one day he could become a cadet and have a career in the armed forces. Wow, that really tells you a mindset that's going through Warner. And I'm sure there had to be a little bit of a chip on Pop's shoulder. This was the first time one of his teams that he coached faced the powerful cadets of Army on a football field. And he, as Anderson says, pushed away as a teenager by the military academy and didn't plan on getting knocked off course again by them. The other pressing thing that had to be, he was so close to a national title that he could taste it. You know, Army was one of four teams that they had yet to play that season. And winning, you know, this one against Army, and as well as a contest against Penn, Springfield, YMCA, and Brown, which were no slouches either in that day, well, that would put Carlisle in a very good place indeed. And he had to, I'm sure, keep focused on one game at a time, no matter how tempting it was to look ahead. But you really couldn't look ahead at Army because they were gigantic. They were a precision machine of playing as close to old school football as you could without the mass momentum plays and interlock blocking and that the sort that had been illegalized in the last few years leading up to this game. They were just a power run game and used their strength and just powered their way up the middle to just bludgeon opponents. So this was going to indeed be a challenge. Now, just before kickoff, Lars Anderson used that minutes right before the game started to reflect on what he believes each of the key figures was thinking and saying. And, you know, and I don't doubt it. I mean, it is very believable in Anderson's book. Like I said, if I haven't said it enough already, this is definitely a book that you want to get your hands on and purchase. And it's available on Amazon. We're going to put a link on it on our website, pigskindispatch.com, in the Carlisle versus Army articles. And we'll even try to put a link to it in our show notes of these podcasts. Now, Anderson starts off with Army football team and their fans. They looked at the Carlisle team that was favored to beat them in utter disbelief. When the teams entered the field, Army outsized the natives by almost 4 inches and 20-some-odd pounds per man. You know, the cadets up in the stands were watching the game. They had to be looking down, you know, as Anderson says, and saying, you know, what the heck? Did the Carlisle send their high school team instead of, you know, their varsity college-age players? You know, who was this team that came in here? They were not as organized in precision as the disciplined Army team was. And, you know, Army had great size. Now, Pop Warner, but he knew that this was his chance to prove his gridiron genius and coaching prowess. He wanted to prove that his new finesse style of play was better than the physical power run game of Army, than that brains and speed could out-duel brawn. Pop was an innovator. This was new age football. You know, this isn't the football that we're used to where you use strategy to defeat a bigger opponent. This is like something totally new And, you know, his single wing offense that came out about 5 years earlier, 1907, that had started the ball rolling. But this was going to be a true test of the great coach's innovation and ingenuity. He even went so far to pull everything out of the pregame coaching book as well. You know, any of you young coaches that are wanting to know how to fire your team up, well, here's this might be to the extreme of that, but he really came out to get his team fired up. And he used this whole subject of the players being Native Americans and the Army being soldiers, that he said that the cadets were the sons of the soldiers that slaughtered their people at Wounded Knee just 21, 22 years earlier. Now, this is the time where that these men could avenge the losses of their tribes. And being inside the military compound at West Point and watching row after row of precise marching columns of cadets of white men made their awareness even more sensitized and heightened the frenzy that they were being worked into by their coach. The strategy worked because, to a man, each of the Indian players knew there was some truth to what Warner was saying, and talk about a pep talk. These boys were fired up to the 10th power before kickoff. Boy, can you think about it? Doesn't it make the hair on the back of your necks stand up? You know, just the anticipation getting into this game. Well, Lars Anderson goes to tell you what's going through Dwight D. Eisenhower's mind as well. He was solely focused on being the best football player he could be. Remember, he was a determined young man. He spent years preparing his body and increasing his foot speed, you know, to make that baseball team that we talked about earlier of the West Point. You know, he had to do it just to make it into West Point. And now, just last few months, he had gotten on the football team. But now he was preparing himself that he wanted to be the star of that team, and he was. And he prepared his body, he prepared his mind, and he would run through his head, you know, just those dream scenario plays of what he expected. And, you know, big belief, you know, we've had the last few decades of, you know, imagining what you want to happen and it will happen. Well, this was being practiced back in 1912 by Dwight D. Anderson, according to Lars Anderson, the author. And his dream scenario was that Thorpe would be carrying the ball. The greatest athlete in the world, just won, you know, Olympic gold a few months earlier in Stockholm. And here's Dwight D. Eisenhower. He wanted to show off his athletic prowess, too, and all the hard work that he had done. So his dream scenario is Thorpe's carrying the ball. Dwight D. Eisenhower wanted to rack and light up Thorpe so much so that he would be injured and not be able to finish the game. That was his dream scenario, and he was looking for that rocking hit to on Thorpe to knock him out of that game. And the Army team was at home, and they had the cheering columns of gray-clad soldiers in the stands cheering them on, and they outsized their opponents by a fair measure. So Army, too, they were getting fired up. They're on home turf. Nobody's coming into our house, especially this smaller team of natives that looks a little bit disorganized and wearing less sort of shoddy uniforms because they can't afford what... You know, we are Army. We're in our black and gold, and we're at our best with our fans behind us. That's the mindset going on. So the Army players are fired up. Dwight D. Eisenhower's fired up. Thorpe's fired up. Yeah, Thorpe's fired up. He's not only because of Pop Warner's game and his rah-rah speech, but also because he knew after receiving accolades over the last few months that being the greatest athlete in the world after his Olympic endeavors, he had to truly come out and prove his athletic prowess against the mighty Goliath foe in the Army cadets on their home field. You know, nobody thought he could do too much against them. Even though Carlisle was favored, they were sitting there wondering, yeah, hey, Thorpe is a great athlete, but can his smallish team go up against these, you know, gigantic, well-oiled machine of Army and outplay them and defeat them? Well, that was what everybody was anticipating. All the pieces were in place for this much-anticipated game of the 1912 season. It was going to be Carlisle versus Army 1912. We're going to take just a little bit of a break. We'll be back with what happened in the game in just a moment after this message.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, it's found right here on the Sports History Network. The soundtrack is provided by Raphael Crux from filmmusic.io.
It was game time. The crowd was cheering. And Army was going to be kicking off the ball to Jim Thorpe, who was deep for Carlisle. Carlisle would get that ball first. And they rocked a kick. And Thorpe got under it, caught the ball cleanly, you know, somewhere around the 15-yard line, and ran it out to almost the 30-yard line before he was stopped by the Army defenders. And, you know, everything was set now. Now, Army was sitting there preparing. They knew 1907 that Warner came up with this genius play of formation of the single wing. Great formation. We call it today, we call it the Wildcat formation, of having, you know, a back receiving the ball that could run, could pass. Well, the single wing, traditionally, back how Warner devised it, it was such misdirection. You'd have, you know, your four backs in the backfield, and any one of them possibly could be receiving the snap for one. And if you did have one particular person receiving the snap, what we would call a quarterback today, I think they called it a halfback then, he could, you know, spin, putting his back to the line of scrimmage and having his other backfield mates crossing back behind him, and any one of them could be getting the ball or getting it flipped to him, or the halfback that took the snap could run with the ball himself behind blockers. In just a total misdirection, not knowing who has the ball, you know, a Houdini act of sorts for a defender to try to figure out where the ball was, which way it was going, and just, you know, chaos if you're a defender. And I've officiated single wing games that ran that way, and they are truly a thing of beauty to watch. Very confusing, even as an official. I'm sitting in the offensive backfield. I'm not having to look over a big offensive and defensive line like a linebacker or a defensive back has to. I'm sitting back there with a clear show of it, and it was hard to keep track of the team I was watching that was running this, because it was brilliant. And I can see why teams had trouble with it. Well, Army, they were ready for it. Other teams since 1907, remember we're in 1912 now, had been running the single wing because of its success. It was a brilliant concept. And this was sort of the offense du jour, you know, the one that a lot of teams were trying out. And so Army had faced this before, and they practiced against it, and they figured out ways and devised ways to stop it by using their superior strength, size, and discipline to just, you know, have their players stay home and do their jobs, you know. And that would stop. That's what would stop the single wing. If you got confused and got tricked into getting out of position, that's where the single wing will burn you. Well, Army was having no part of that. So that's what they felt they were prepared for. Well, Pop Warner was no dummy. He knew, too, that Army was going to be doing it. So he came up with a concept that had been, you know, he'd been noodling in that noggin of his for a while, and this was the time to unleash it. He's outmanned, outsized. His players had been, you know, traveling quite a bit, playing games. Army's at home. You know, just things didn't look like they were going well for him. He knew that the single wing could be stopped by Army because he had heard that they could do that against other opponents. So he devised a whole new offense. He called it the double wing. And he came out, and his quarterback halfback, whatever they would call it at the time, would take the snap, and the formation was totally different than the single wing, but it had the misdirection. And so, you know, play after play on his first drive, 15-yard runs, 10-yard runs, flip the ball to Thorpe, he'd get a 15-yard run, fake handoffs, reverses, all misdirection, going around the ends, just catching Army flat-footed, off guard. You know, they're surprised at the speed of the Carlisle Indians, who were very quick, very athletic, smaller, but very quick, very athletic, and they used that to their advantage. And they knifed their way right down the field. And then on a play, it was from probably about the 15, 20-yard line, as it's described, Thorpe took one of these misdirections. He's going around the end and broke a couple tackles. He's down to the 10, down to the 5. There's one player left to get by. It's Dwight D. Eisenhower. Eisenhower, in the back of his mind, he's thinking, okay, dream scenario that I've been thinking about for weeks. Hey, it's game on right now. And Eisenhower lit into the smaller Thorpe with everything he had and hit him so hard that the ball came jarred loose. It popped out. Thorpe fumbled. And he just freaking crushed Thorpe, taken to the ground, that ball loose, and punished Thorpe with this hit. And Army jumps on the ball, recovers it, deep in their own territory. They stop the Carlisle initial surge. But even better yet, though, they're all applauding and cheering. They look back, and Thorpe is on the ground, wincing in pain. So now you look over at the sideline. Pop Warner's sitting there. Oh, no, his worst nightmare. His star player, Thorpe, appears to be hurt. His team just lost all the momentum they gained on their first drive, moved the ball right down the field. The double wing offense is working the strategy perfectly. His team and his players are executing the strategy to perfection. But now they're missing their key cog. They're one guy that Army fears, and the greatest athlete in the world, Jim Thorpe. He's laying on the ground. So Thorpe is laying there. He's not getting up. And Warner is described as take a long drag on his cigarette. Sounds odd, coaches smoking on the sideline, but it happened then. Takes a long drag to calm his nerves a little bit. Thorpe is still down on the ground. Warner goes to start walking out there to go check on his star player. He's preparing himself for the worst and trying to strategize how is he going to get through the rest of this game without Thorpe. So, who's not only a great offensive weapon, he's a great defensive weapon as well. So as Warner's walking out there, the official starts calling out to Warner and to Thorpe saying, hey, he's looking at his watch. You got to get him off the field. We don't have time for this. Let's get going here. Drag him off the field and let's get playing. Well, one of the cadets, the captain, the quarterback, one of the star players, DeVore of Army, goes to the official, hey, don't worry about it. If he needs time to get up, he's aching, He just got railed. And Thorpe laid on the ground. All of a sudden, he heard this, and he popped up. He was incensed and felt belittled by DeVore, thinking, almost like it was an act of condemnation. He felt that Thorpe was inferior to him, and so he would need to lay on the ground, almost, because he wasn't as good as the Army players who didn't get hurt. And this incensed Thorpe, and now that rage and that fire was even turned up another notch. The oven is stoked. And Thorpe, back then you didn't have to come out of the game after the play. So Thorpe, they had to play defense, and they stuffed Army. And punt next up, after the set of downs, they held them, and Army punted. And Thorpe wasn't back for this punt because, just being a little bit injured. I think Warner probably gave him a breather from at least returning the kick. And so he didn't protect him from all the hits he would take on that. So Army came out and they stuffed him again. And so now Carlisle punts. Well, Army decides to get a little bit of rhythm now. They are getting the ball, and they are starting to pound it up the middle, pretty good. They're just running up the middle using their size, strength, athleticism, to just overpower Carlisle. And you know, their whole strategy is, you know, much like we have today. If you're bigger and stronger, the more you pound on that defensive line and up the middle, you know, it might not work, it might stop you at first, but eventually it's going to wear you down. You're going to get tired, and you're going to be overcome by the fourth quarter later in the game, and that's when, you know, the damage can really be done. So Army starts pounding away, having some success. They're moving the ball, and they start driving deep into Carlisle territory, and eventually they end up scoring, you know, the touchdown. You know, Carlisle put up a good goal line stand. They stopped them cold on first and second down, and then they ran a sweep with Dwight D. Eisenhower leading the way, and with DeVore behind him. And you know, they pound the ball into the end zone. You know, Ike has some vicious blocks as lead blocker. Great runner, but a great blocker as well. You know, ferocious hits, and knocks some Indian players out of the way. They get into the end zone, but they miss the extra point. So that deflates them just a little bit, but the Cadets, they're pretty happy about the whole thing. And now Carlisle gets the ball back, and they move the ball down the field. They're starting to sit the double wing again, and it's misdirection and Thorpe, and you know, another player there, and just using their agility and their speed and misdirection, their whole concept, move the ball down the field. They get down in tight, and Army holds them. Army has the ball about their 5-yard line, and as common in that day, teams that back that far, there's nothing really good that can happen. They don't think they can work their way out of that with just a running game. They know the line's going to get stacked up, whatnot. It's common back in that era for teams to punt when they're deep in their own territory, get themselves out of trouble. So that's what Army does. They set back and they kick the ball, and it's a high kick, and it's long. And Jim Thorpe is back to receive the punt, and he's back about his own 45-yard line, and it's so high in the air, it gave time for the Army punt team to get down under the ball. They have Thorpe circled with four men. He catches the ball, and chaos happens. So Thorpe is backpedaling, sidestepping, breaks loose of all four of those men, goes through and escapes tackle after tackle, all the way down the field. Might be one of the greatest plays in college football history, as is described. And too bad they didn't have film back then. But Thorpe goes all the way to the end zone. People are astonished. I mean, the Army field is littered with Eisenhower and Hobbs and the rest of the DeVore. All of them are like laying on the ground, you know, dumbfounded that this man, Jim Thorpe, escaped all their tackles and made it all the way to the end zone. So the Carlisle Indians are celebrating, but wait a second. Here comes an official coming in, waving his arms, and tells everybody, oh, no, I had a holding call back here against Carlisle. Was it a phantom call? It didn't seem like there was a whole bunch of complaint. But Thorpe went up as captain. He had the right to do this. He went to the official and said, hey, who was the holding call on? And he pointed at the referee, decided to point out to the player on Carlisle that did it, and Thorpe, you know, chastised him, sent him to the bench for the holding call, sent him back away. So back at that time, the punt rules are not the same as now with a penalty on a punt. So Army was to re-kick, and this time they were much smarter. They kicked it away from Thorpe, ended up getting the stop that they wanted with another player returning the ball. So you know, that touchdown was called back. Carlisle has another punt return. They're stopped. They have the ball, and they can't move the ball. Army defense is just too tight. They can't get into the end zone, can't get much of anything. Now, the teams each were held in check the rest of the half, and they trotted off to the sidelines to go to their respective locker rooms, Carlisle leading 7-6. In the Army locker room, you know, those guys were sucking some wind. There was cups of water being passed around, and you know, it was near freezing that day. It wasn't a hot day by any means. You know, there was scenes described by Lars Anderson as, you know, the Carlisle players huddled under sideline under red blankets, much like you would picture, you know, Indian villages in the cold winters with buffalo hides on. Well, they had these red blankets on them. You know, Army they were trying to be, you know, macho and tough and doing it. But those guys, those boys from Army, they were sucking some wind. They had been chasing some little smaller speed demons from sideline to sideline every single play, especially the two middle linebackers, which were Eisenhower and another player named Hobbs. And these two, they pulled each other over to the side. Eisenhower had a strategy, and he got with Hobbs and said, "Hey, you know, we gotta take care of this. And I'm tired of chasing this guy Thorpe around." You know, they both looked at each other and talked and said, "You know, the newspapers and the media at the time did this man no justice. They said he was a great athlete and a great football player. Well, he was even better in person than was being described in the newspapers that they had read about and people talking about him. This dude was, you know, just, he was like God's gift of the perfect football player, a well-tuned machine and speed, power, ferocity, and he knew what to do with the football. He was dangerous. And Hobbs and Eisenhower decided, hey, they needed to give him the old 1-2. And what they meant by that is Eisenhower would get the opportunity and he would just land another crushing blow on Thorpe, everything he had up high into the chest. And as he did that, Hobbs was to come in low and just crush the lower extremities, the legs of Thorpe, and hopefully put him out of the game on the sideline and maybe even into the infirmary at West Point. You know, they were going to do it legally. They weren't going to do it cheap shots, but they were going to hit this guy to let him know the what for, what was going on here, because he was too dangerous to keep on the field. And that was the strategy going into the second half for these two players from Army. And the rest of the Army guys, you know, they're, like we said, they're getting their water, they're getting their air, and they're saying, oh boy, what are we in for the second half? You know, this team is good. They're everything that everybody said about them and more. And even though they're small, boy, you cannot be underestimated, because these players from Carlisle are good and they are well coached and have some good strategies of what they're doing with the ball. So that's what was going into the second half. And we'll have the second half of the game coming up right after this. All right, so Army comes out in the second half. They receive the second half kickoff. And offensively, they can't move the ball again. They're stymied by this great Carlisle plan to stop their offense. You know, they're bigger and better trying to go up the middle, but the Carlisle players, being smaller, are also quicker, and they're beating them off the ball and getting around them and making tackles behind the blockers. So the Indians get the ball here a little bit later in the second half, and they decide to run a play where Thorpe and another player are lead blockers for one of the Carlisle runners. And we talked earlier about the captain of the Army team, DeVore. And DeVore is described, he's a big man, he's a good athlete, 240-pounder. You know, that's gigantic for that era. And this guy's a monster. And by far the best blocker and probably best tackler on the team, you know, stuffing the run, because he can dominate the line. Well, Thorpe and this other player, lead blockers, their whole tactic is to go out there and take DeVore out of the play. And they do a tactic of blocking that Warner teaches, where you run at the opponent and you leave your feet. You like launch yourself into the opponent, the defender. And that's what both of them do, and just blast DeVore. Knock him, you know, he's seeing the sky when they're done with this play. He's on his the ground, and he's livid. He's angry as all get out. As you know, the Indians go down and they end up scoring, taking a 14-6 lead. DeVore is extremely angry. You have the next kickoff after the score, and they kick off, and he is watching one of the players on Carlisle. This gentleman named Guyon, who was the other one with Thorpe that took DeVore out on the double block. And you know, DeVore's not thinking about anything other than he's going to get a little bit of revenge back on this Guyon. He can't get a hold of Thorpe. Thorpe's a little bit too quick. But this Guyon is watching downfield the runner that's returning the ball. You know, DeVore is a lead blocker. and he just comes out and just plasters Guyon, cheap shots him, blindsides him. You know, it would be a penalty in today's era. Well, it ended up being so flagrant and so brutal, it was a penalty in that day. And it ended up getting DeVore ejected from the game when the officials ejected the star player, the captain of Army, their best blocker, 240-pound DeVore, from the game. He is removed. And now Army's reeling. They're down 14-6 at home. They can't get much going on offense. And now their best blocker, who, you know, who they were pinning their hopes on of Eisenhower, you know, running behind and others, he's gone. He's no longer a factor in this game. And so tide was really quickly turning, and Army was starting to get into desperation mode as the third quarter was waning. So the game continued, and Carlisle ended up getting the ball back, and they started running the ball up the middle, just you know, no DeVore there to stop them. So there's a little bit of advantage they can gain by running up the middle. So they're running Thorpe up the middle, and on one play, he breaks free. And the two linebackers, you know, Eisenhower and Hobbs, now they had that halftime plan, and this is the time where they could really take advantage of that because they both had an eyeballs on Thorpe. He's running down the field, Ike and Hobbs in pursuit, and they're coming from two different directions at him and going full force, and they're going to lay a lick on Thorpe. He's not going to forget. Well, the instinctive Thorpe does his famous start-stop move, and he just stops on a dime. And picture this, Eisenhower and Hobbs are airborne to crush this fella, and he stops, they totally miss him and crash into each other with all the vicious hit that they had planned out for Jim Thorpe. And, you know, he cuts back and gets a nice gain out of it, and no pain from Ike and Hobbs. But the two that took the brunt of the hit, well, it's Eisenhower and Hobbs. And Eisenhower especially is hobbled by this play. I mean, Lars Anderson describes both Eisenhower and Hobbs as being at the point of unconsciousness from the vicious hit. Now, pretty soon, Eisenhower blinked and became alert. He was foggy. You know, he was limping a little bit. He got up slowly. Hobbs was dazed, and he eventually... Hobbs got up and staggered to the sideline to seek some medical help. And Eisenhower, you know, he was hurt, but he really wanted to stay in the game because he still wanted to give Thorpe that, you know, that big hit. He wanted him to remember, you know, Ike Eisenhower in the game. But begrudgingly, you know, Eisenhower was removed from the game, and because they knew they needed him for the rest of the season. If he was injured, he wasn't doing them any good. So they end up putting Omar Bradley. Remember, we talked about General Bradley playing football too. Put him into the game, and he took the place of one of those two along with another substitute. Now, Carlisle had full reign of anything they really wanted to do on offense now. Those three best players of Army are out, the best defenders. Thorpe is just running wild. And it ends up, the game finishes. Eisenhower couldn't even bear to watch the rest of the game from the sideline. He was so upset. Carlisle 27, Army 6 is your final. And what a tremendous game it was. I mean, the score isn't indicative of how good of a game it was played. Losing those three players in the second half, one foolishly by DeVore. I guess the other two kind of foolishly too. If they were just made to tackle on Thorpe, maybe neither one of them gets injured and can still stay in the game. But Carlisle, their strategy and their athleticism was just too much for Army, and they were getting through this. And I don't know if maybe Army couldn't have come back on this, because maybe they were the ones getting worn down from chasing these smallish, fast, athletic players from Carlisle all over the field, especially Jim Thorpe. And, you know, Thorpe got his scores, he got his touches, got out of there without injury, you know, had the scare there in the first half. But just think about what this game did. You had, you know, Omar Bradley playing this game. A great general, won the Battle of the Bulge, was a commanding general of the Battle of the Bulge, a major victory over the Germans. His boss, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was, you know, in charge of the whole Allied war effort in the European theater, and ended up becoming president of the United States, less than a decade later. Jim Thorpe becomes, one of the greatest football players, baseball players, athletes. Didn't do so as good at baseball as he did at football, but he goes on to play professional football. Canton Bulldogs and Chicago Bears, I think he played a little bit with, and bounced around a little bit. But he's probably one of the greatest athletes of all time, and he too becomes a president of the APFA, the American Professional Football Association, which 2 years after that, Thorpe wasn't in charge anymore, he was just president that first year, becomes the National Football League. Yeah, that's what it was. So both of these gentlemen became president. Omar Bradley, a highly decorated general, a great warrior. Ike is a great warrior, president. Pop Warner, he moves on, goes to, I believe, Pittsburgh, and has a bunch of undefeated seasons there, some great football teams. Goes out to Stanford, has some great teams at Stanford. Then comes back and is a coach at Temple. Just an awesome innovator of the game. What a mind for the game of football Pop Warner had. And like I said, I think, he is one of the top innovators of the game of football that made it what it is today. He and three others, him and Walter Camp and Amos Alonzo Stagg and great Paul Brown a few years later, just really shaped the game into what it is. And this game of football, played in 1912 by Carlisle and Army, and the build-up and the excellent job of writing the book by Lars Anderson. I can't say this enough. I mean, you've got to get a copy of this book and read all the gritty details that he really gets in. His research is impeccable and is just a work of art. Great football history, great American history in this book, I will say that. And I'm not so sure that this story is totally done with the end of this game. I just gave you the aftermath, what happens to them years later with the key figures. But the next week for Carlisle is an extremely interesting game, too, in 1912. Carlisle was going to play the University of Pennsylvania. And that'll be our topic next time when we talk about some of the great games in football history. We're going 1912 Carlisle versus Penn. And you can hear it right here on pigskindispatch.com. So thank you very much for your time listening today. Thank you, Mark J., for the great idea of reading this book and talking about it. Excellent game, and I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun to research and read and even chat about here with you. And hope to see you next time, and next time could be tomorrow, because we have another great topic tomorrow for our Pigskin Dispatch. And each and every day we're here talking great football history, but next week we'll talk about that Carlisle and Penn game. So till tomorrow, everybody, have a great gridiron day.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that. Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.